right. Okay, let's just start by you telling me a little bit about yourself, kind of what your hobbies are. What are you passionate about as an individual?
Passionate about?
Yeah.
Your kids? Yeah, I mean, I think passionate about. So probably passionate about helping people.
Okay.
That would be passionate about. I mean, I got kids. I like my, yeah, I love my kids. You know, I got an older kid that's she's in college, actually getting her PhD. I have two younger children. One's 14, one's 13, and they're great kids. Like to, you know, hang out with them. As far as on a, I guess more along personal, or I mean, more personal stuff. You know, I like hobbies and I like things that go fast. Motorcycles, four-wheelers, things like that. So I like things that keep a person entertained or mentally engaged.
Always got to be on the edge of your seat.
Yeah, you got to be engaged. So, and then as far as on more of a business level, I think I just like the challenge of accomplishment, to see if you can do it, if you can pull it off. And that's kind of a disease. It's good and bad. So... does that answer that question?
It's gonna build on itself. That's a good start.
All right.
This is a little bit more of a personal question too. What college did you go to for your undergrad?
I didn't.
You didn't?
No.
Those are the best. Best story. What did you do when you first started out then? Kind of where did you build to where you're here now?
Well, when my dad graduated college, four of his college buddies started Pizza Hut. And he worked in Pizza Huts in the early days. He then became a developer for Pizza Hut and developed stores throughout the south end of the United States, Florida, Atlanta, Texas. All through there, he built stores. I was very young at that point in time. Later on, he got out of Pizza Hut. He owned some Pizza Huts, but he got out of Pizza Hut. And I went to work for him. We developed some Skyline Chili's throughout Toledo, Dayton, Columbus, and when they sold those franchises off, a few friends of mine, we went into Subway and became a Subway franchisee, and that was in 89, so about 22, 23 years ago, and
I can't believe it was that long.
Yeah, I did Subway for up until, I still have Subways, up until 2007, we started Hothead, and so we've been doing the Hothead thing.
So you were with some friends with the Subway, but then you and your wife decided, hey, this is our idea, let's take this thing forward.
That is correct. Yep. Actually, yes, I had two partners in my first Subway deals. We bought one of them out early on, and then in 99, we sold our stores, and then my wife and I decided to get back into Subway, and so we did. And then in 2007, we started Hothead.
Okay. How many, just a curious side note, how many of those Subways do you still have?
10.
10?
Mm-hmm.
They do well for you still?
Yes, they do. Yep, Subway's a good company.
You still, which have you grown more into, I'm guessing, the Hothead role?
Yeah, I mean, Hothead's more consuming. You know, Subway's a good concept, but Subway is very established, and there really isn't any other areas to build Subways. So as far as a growth vehicle, it's kind of no longer really a growth vehicle. So if I said, hey, I want to go, you know, build another 50 stores, it's not going
to
happen.
It's going to have to be up in, like, the mountains of Canada or something like that.
Right, yeah. Or if I want to go to, you know, France or something, I don't know.
But, and then it's probably already there, too.
Yeah, and as a, you know, the franchisor, to build a franchisor like Hothead is, it's kind of like, you know, it's a heck of a challenge. See if you can pull it off.
So what is that? What is being the Hothead franchisor, owner, operator? I'm sure you have several roles. What does that really entail on your end at this point? Let's start from the beginning. Where you were when you first started your first store and developed into the role you're in now.
I think as a franchisor, it's probably not what people would think it is. You have to just think about it like this. If you're going to think of it as writing a manual, and let's sit down and write a 400-page manual about how to run a company and how to make a product, and with that thought, you can imagine the all of the details and all of the decisions. You're compiling a concept. So, you know, when you're a franchisee of Subway or another franchisee or franchisee of anything, when you have a plastic fork that you get from your distributor, you look at that plastic fork and go, it's just a plastic fork. Well, it took a lot of time and energy to get that plastic fork, let me tell you. And it's not just a plastic fork. There's a lot of reasons why that plastic fork is being used and not the other 25 plastic forks that are available. So when you do a franchisor, it is about building stores. It is about developing a brand. But a lot of it comes down to developing a system that operates that brand. For instance, anyone can come up with a great tasting food. But coming up with great tasting food and coming up with great tasting food that can be produced over and over by employees who have other things on their mind and make it come out tasting right, that's an accomplishment. See, I can come up with great, you know, hot sauces, but can you come up with a great hot sauce that can actually be manufactured and on the shelf and come to the consumer and still taste great? It's way big.
I mean, part of it has to be in the fact that people build their own things. So, I mean, if it tastes bad, it's on them, kind of.
Kind of, to a degree, yeah. You know. But again, you know, when you're dealing with people, you know, employees that are running those restaurants, they have to have a product that that will come out consistently.
Yeah, you don't have someone that really is putting their heart and soul into cooking chicken.
Exactly. I mean, we don't have chefs back there, and we could have chefs back there, but your burrito would be $20,
yeah.
You know, because chefs aren't cheap. So, you know, it's a concept. If you think of franchising, it's a concept of producing a product consistently, and that's what truly franchising is.
And it works.
It's proven. It seems to be working pretty good so far.
Okay. Turn it in a different direction here. I'm glad I got a little bit of background because I did want to know exactly what you're doing on this. And it seems like at this point, you're more in the role of, you went from actually getting in your hands in there, figuring out what it was all about, to now this kind of parenting role where you're like, I see all the things happening and you respond to what happens.
Correct. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're actually directing the company. And you're making a lot of decisions that are going to take the company in different directions. And the trick is to figure out what direction it should go in.
Quick side note, how often do you step your foot in a store?
Almost daily.
Yeah.
You know, but I don't really make burritos anymore. I mean, I could. And I don't mind doing it, but I don't. Just because we have a lot of people and I have plenty to do.
Yeah, I imagine.
I have a long list of duties. I'm sorry, I got off track there.
I took you off track.
It's now it comes down to, you know, you got to steer the boat, and that's really important. And it's not a speedboat. So.
Okay. Let's move on a little bit here. We've gone over a couple of these, and it's the reason.
Sure, you can revisit it.
It's intended to flow this way, though. I was going to ask if you'd. This is your first time being an entrepreneur, which definitely isn't. You kind of learned lessons along the way. Here's kind of a note before we move on in a different direction.
Okay.
I remember I asked you earlier before we started the interview, what made you believe that you had a foothold in the seemingly saturated market? So we already have.
It's simple math. It's when you... if you were to look at McDonald's and the sheer volume they do in sales, it would tell you that there's room out there for another competitor to sell hamburgers. 20 minutes.
You want to do lunch
you
later?
You can read it. Yeah, we'll do lunch at about 1 o'clock.
Okay.
Is that cool?
Okay.
I'm sorry.
That's fine.
Yeah, go ahead and eat if you want. I'm sorry. I guess you can edit that.
Don't worry. That I like it in the interview.
When you look at, I'm not a big stock guy and I'm not a Wall Street guy. I don't understand market cap and all that kind of stuff. I can just tell you this: when you see a business that produces a tremendous amount of revenue, there's always room for a competitor. If you see a business in an industry and that industry is trailing downward, then you probably don't want to be a competitor in that industry. But when you see an industry that's growing, Mexican's growing, it can be done. You know, even look at Subway. You know, Subway is a huge company, and there are still chains coming along, such as Firehouse Subs and a couple other ones that are building stores, and they're doing good volume, even though Subway appeared to have saturated it. But it ain't over yet.
They're just tweaking the market to catch up with the times a little bit.
Maybe.
I feel like Hothead's kind of taking on a different, even though it is somewhat similar, it takes on a different role. When you go in, you feel something different.
I think, you know, yeah, I would agree with you. It's
whereas Qdoba and Chipotle, it's really hard to tell those two apart, you know?
What we're doing is we're Americanizing Mexican food. We're making it so that we're not belittling it, and we're not devaluing it. What we're doing is we're making Mexican food just more versatile. You know, I mean, there's a lot of variety you can do with Mexican food, and there's a lot of variety you can do with flavors. And I'm just surprised that other companies haven't explored that more. Does that make sense?
Oh, it does. It's my favorite food, so.
Yeah, I mean.
It's not hard to explain it to me.
Yeah, it's a lot of variety.
Okay, this is a good question to carry on. When you started Hothead and just being an entrepreneur in general, what fears do you experience?
Well, fear of failure, fear of losing lots of money, fear of embarrassment that it didn't work, all the standard fears that you could probably come up with. And we did lose a lot of money in our first store for the first 6 months. But we, you know, I had the financial backing to keep it going in the right direction. I think fear is healthy, but, you know, it's think about it like this. It's entrepreneurism is a hypothesis. It's not a guess. You know, I guess that's the easiest way for me to say.
Educated guess.
Yeah, it's an educated guess. I mean, you don't walk out there and just go for it. No, you've thought it out. You've played it out. You've really, you've made a lot of calculations. So it's not like it's total risk. It is, but it's not blind risk.
Yeah. Okay. This is a good lead in.
All right.
So, I mean, obviously, despite those fears, something pushed you over that hurdle.
So, faith.
Okay.
Yeah, you gotta have faith.
Faith in yourself, faith in your decision, faith from other people.
Faith in yourself, faith in God, faith in your dreams. You know, you have to. It's all about faith. You just can't sit around in life and watch all the opportunities go by. And if you, you know, you can't sit there and say, you can't sit there and say, I want to be a fighter pilot and never get in a plane. You know, there's a tremendous risk in becoming a fighter pilot. You know, but to pull it off and do it well is an awesome rush, I'm sure. Just like entrepreneurism. If you pull it off, it's pretty cool. Yeah. Problem is with most entrepreneurs, they never feel they pulled it off. So they just keep on going.
Yeah.
And it's a progressive realization. As opposed, there's really no end goal, you know.
That's a good question for later, too. Mm-hmm. So now that you have this faith that's carried you kind of over the hurdle, like,
mm-hmm.
and you have the belief in yourself, what gives you the motivation on top of that? What tells you every day, I'm going to get up and this is what I want to do, this is what I love? Is it because love to do?
I wouldn't say it is. No, I'd say it's more that once you start something like this, Well, it's one thing to run your own restaurant. It's one thing to go out and build 5 or 10 restaurants. But really, I mean, as soon as you build a restaurant, you are employing people, and those people are dependent upon you. And especially once you have sold franchises, those people are depending upon you. They're depending upon you to carry this company forward. They're depending upon you to make decisions that are gonna that they're gonna help them in their franchise. And you have a tremendous responsibility to perform. And so, you know, it goes hand in hand with wanting to help people, but it's kind of like, you know, once you jump off the cliff, you're committed. And if you want to go build a franchise, you have to understand that right up front that if you get tired of it one day and say, I don't want to play anymore, that's not an option. You know, that's not an option. You made that decision. You got to stick with it. You know, you have people that rely upon you. I mean, I figure like right now I have 250 employees that work for me, and then I probably have another 200 people that are associated with those franchisees, and they depend upon this company going in the right direction. So there's a huge sense of responsibility. So you get up whether you want to or not.
So it's almost been taken out of your hands, and now...
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
That's something I wasn't expecting. That's a good one.
Well, I mean, and down the road, you can begin to employ people to run those aspects of your company so that you don't necessarily have to be there every day. So it's not like it's a, you know, oh my God, I'm never going to escape this thing. It's not like that, but we're also at a size right now where my input is very important on a daily basis.
Very fragile.
Very fragile, absolutely. You know, like I think the guy from Papa John's said it best. He said, yeah, we just didn't feel like we had it together until we had about 3,000 stores. And I, you know, we'll see.
So this is just a side question. Do you find any time to take breaks?
A little bit.
Here and there?
A little bit, yeah. But not, I mean, again, it's hard, you know, it's hard to take a break. Because you have a lot of people relying upon you. And the other thing is you have so much going on a daily basis that it's really hard. You can't just step away. What are you going to step away and do? You know? I mean, you go sit on a beach? Why? You got way too much on your list of things to do. How's sitting on a beach going to make you feel any better? It's not. You're going to sit on that beach wishing you'd got some more stuff done today.
You're prolonging the inevitable.
Yeah, right, exactly. So, you know, it's you pick the fruit when it's ripe.
When do you think you're going to be able to?
Relax a little bit?
Yeah.
I'd say about 2 years. Yeah. Well, probably a year or two. I'd say about two. Because we'll have a lot of the systems built, and then we'll have a lot of the people in those positions that know how to run those systems. But right now, it's all about building systems, you know, and it's just crazy. I mean, it's a crazy amount of time that it takes to build a system. You know, you'd think it would be easy, but it's not.
I would never think that it's easy. It seems like a huge responsibility. And it seems like, to me, if I was in your position, my biggest fear would be to have, if I do step out, is the person that steps in going to be able to do what I know needs to be done?
Yeah, that's a whole nother world right there. You know, I mean, I have some good people that work for me. There's no doubt about it. But, you know, it's a tough position to fill.
And that's probably when you're going to finally be able to let go, is when you finally have that comfort level.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you just have to build your company to a certain size, you know. And I've seen a lot of people that built a company to a certain size, thought it was under control, stepped away, and the thing crashed. And we're not going to do that. So.
All right, back on track.
Okay.
Do you have any obstacles inside yourself, like emotional barriers?
Everybody does. The biggest battles within.
I know.
Yeah, always. Always is.
Anything specifically?
I wouldn't say, not really. I mean, I think entrepreneurs probably, I think you have two different breeds of entrepreneur. You have the cold and calculated one, and they probably have a really easy time succeeding. And then you have the other entrepreneur who's pretty passionate, and they can succeed quite well too. However, they probably are distraught a lot of the time because they do care how the employees feel. They do care how people are affected by what they do. Whereas the other, cold and calculated, probably makes a really good entrepreneur, but you know, they might leave a wake of
destruction
behind them. I mean, you know.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it.
I don't, you know, I look at probably Bill Gates and people like that as my idols, because, and it's not necessarily that I know Bill Gates or anything, but I'm just saying that I don't. You can't look at Bill Gates and say he was lucky. Okay, he may have been fortunate to be in the right time, at the right, you know, right place at the right time, but that was a very small part of what built Microsoft. What built Microsoft was his ability to build Microsoft. You know, I don't think it was luck. You know,
not at all.
Not at all. Absolutely not. The guy's a genius.
Yeah.
You know, he's probably pretty cold. I would venture to say he's probably more cold and calculated than he is passionate.
Well, it's hard to be passionate now at the level that you're at. You have to be cold and calculated when you get to
a
that
little
size,
bit.
I feel like.
You know,
when you have 3,000 stores yourself, you're not going to be like, well, this guy's feeling down here.
Yeah, right. Because you're dealing with masses. It's just like, you know, walking onto a battlefield. You know, you drag 10,000 people on that battlefield. The name of the game is to bring as many home as possible. It's not to care about each and every one of them.
But hopefully you'll have a district manager at some level that is caring.
Yeah.
Okay. What, in establishing this brand and this store, what was your biggest obstacle?
Supply chain management, which is getting the products you want to your store and getting them at the right price and having them available. That's a huge hurdle.
In this case, finding the right food vendor or finding supplies for in the store.
All of that, because you have three levels to it. You have the manufacturer. One, you have to find the product that you like. And then you have to have a manufacturer who's willing to work with you, who makes that product. Then you have a distributor that moves that product for you, delivers it. And then, you know, you have inside the stores, you have the hassles or the challenges of that product actually performing like you want it to. You know, and I mean that sounds really simple, but I mean let's just look at.
Well, you have straws, you have napkins.
Straws, yeah, straw. You know, let's talk about a silly little straw.
Yeah.
You know, when the customer grabs it and pounds it on the counter to make the straw paper fall off, the paper needs to fall off. Because if it doesn't, he breaks the straw. And if he breaks the straw, he gets another straw. Well, now I just spent twice as much money giving that guy a straw. And all those things are factors, they're issues. You know, napkins. You know, just all sorts of stuff. There's so many customer perceptions that come into a product, whether they're going to like that product, and that product's got to perform. That's the easiest way for us to say it. But supply chain management is huge. It's not easy. It's ever changing. Products change. Government, you know, restrictions or whatever change. It never ends.
So just on top of that, this is another side.
Mm-hmm.
I like doing these sides. How did you finally find that one that satisfied you?
The products? Just a lot of hours. A lot of hours of playing with different products. And it's just not easy. I mean, like for instance, we have what's called hothead sauce. And my wife and I used to make that hothead sauce once a week. And, you know, when we got to the point where we were making probably 100 gallons a week, I mean, we couldn't do it anymore. So we had to have a bottler do it. Well, taking that product the way Cindy and I made it versus a mass production bottler, it took us a year to get the flavor to taste right.
Really?
Yeah, and it's still not right. I mean, it's close. Consumer probably won't notice it, but we notice it. But still, it's a year. It took us a year to get there, you know? And it's tough. I mean,
and it could be the difference between buying, you know, just if it's a sauce, Daisy sour cream versus sour cream from some other.
Absolutely. All sour creams are different. Every one of them are different, you know. And that's another thing. You know, you got all these products in your store that you're using, and all of a sudden a distributor or a manufacturer decides, hey, we're going to discontinue that product. You're like, hold on a second. You just affected my flavor profile. And so now you have to quickly go out, find another product, and make any adjustments to it, you know, seasoning-wise, to make it equal what the other thing tasted like. And you have to do all this without your consumer picking it out. And sometimes the consumer picks it out, and a lot of times they don't. And it's not about cheapening the product. It's just about keeping, you know, product available.
How many branches do you have in your supply chain?
Branches? Well, we use one distributor right now.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah, it's good and bad. But, yeah, we use one distributor. We use U.S. Foods right now, and they distribute all of our product, and that works pretty well.
Cups, straw, everything?
Mm-hmm.
Custom make your hothead cups? And.
Well, we have, you know, for instance, like Solo makes the cups. So they make those, and they distribute them to U.S. Foods, and U.S. Foods distribute them to us. And so you have all these manufacturers out there making all these products that have to come into U.S. Foods, and then U.S. Foods ships them out to our stores. But, you know, you have to monitor to make sure that the manufacturer is keeping up with as many as you need. For instance, we ran out of cups for about 5 days, about a month ago, on medium cups, because it just, you know, we're building stores. The temperatures were hotter outside than we anticipated. The hotter the temperatures are, the more pop you move, because people are becoming dehydrated. They drink more, and we used more cups than we thought, and therefore we ran out.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's supply chain management. You know, someone should have been watching the thermometer better and said, man, we're at 94 degrees, and we have been for a week, and look at our cup counts, you know, is up. So, but you're forecasting out 13 weeks. So it's hard to forecast and estimate 13 weeks from now.
A lot of variables that come into consideration.
Oh, it'll drive you crazy.
Do you have someone that does that for you now, hopefully?
No, kind of. It takes about three of us to keep a handle on it.
Oh.
Yeah.
Jeez. Okay. Okay, this is another important question. This will be the last three questions will be associated with this.
Okay.
How have partnerships and business worked out for you thus far?
Do you mean partnerships like with a manufacturer or a partnership with a person that I go into business with?
You know, that's a very interesting question, because I had, when I posed that question to another entrepreneur, a guy that owns a dot-commer,
mm-hmm.
he said, he kind of changed it into, well, my partner, he did see all the different partnerships he does have. He said the partnership with he owns a company with his wife too, and he said that partnership's worked out real well. And then he said he has realized he's had to rely on so many people that he's realized that partnerships aren't necessary no matter what. So my question, I guess, engineered differently would be, what partnerships have you seen as effective and other partnerships ineffective and your reliance on them?
Well, that's a pretty deep question. I would say that...
Let's start with just your wife.
I think if you're going to have a partner, it's probably best to be your wife.
She won't stab you in the back.
Well, yeah. That's very true. Well, you have a common goal, and that's the most important thing. Because when you have partnerships that are not your spouse, then you don't have a common goal. And I've had partnerships, and I still have partnerships today with different people. But I know in the past, if you have two people who are partners running a company, you can run into some serious friction as to who's working harder, who has put more into the company. Whereas when you're in a marriage, it really doesn't matter who put more into the company, because it's you're sharing the asset with your spouse. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So I would caution people to partnerships. Be very careful with them, and don't do them without having an agreement, a written agreement, because they can get really ugly really quick.
That's the second time I've heard that.
Yeah, trust me. But partner, I think life is a partnership. You know, I mean, you and I have a small partnership here. I'm sharing my story. You're going to put it in print. I'm probably going to benefit from that at some point, but you're going to benefit from it, probably more so than I will. And if nothing else, this conversation will have an impact on your life. And that's probably the most important thing that's happening in this room right now. So everybody has partnerships going on left and right. You know, I have partners in business. I have partners in construction companies. Not that we have a partnership where we own part of it, but that we do business together, and we all benefit from that. I guess that's the easiest way to say it.
No, that's exactly what it was.
Partnerships are not always in writing, nor are they financially binding. That makes sense?
It does. Okay. So, let's put it this way, and this goes back to you and your wife. Do you think you have had the motivation to accomplish this on your own?
I don't think so. I probably wouldn't have accomplished this project without my wife, but I'm sure I would have accomplished other projects without my wife, because my wife was probably the spearhead of saying, let's go to a burrito chain. Mm-hmm. You know, for me, I probably would have done something else, but this is fine. It worked out.
Guess so.
You know.
This is kind of an easy question for you. Have you always seen yourself being an entrepreneur?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. From when I was a little kid. Yeah.
So you're kind of living the dream.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Yeah. Yeah, always like that.
Okay. So this is the last question. Mm-hmm. And you kind of talked to it earlier, and you said there was no end goal in sight, but there's got to be. What is that?
Well, for me or for the company?
Both.
Well, I just like to be an inventor. That's at heart what I'd like to do. So this is a means to an end. At some point, you're going to want to get out of it and sell it off or whatever. But, I mean, that might be 20 years from now. I might be 70. You know. But at some point, I'd like to take some time and just be an inventor. Because it's fun.
You know, that's funny. Everyone I've talked to that's been an entrepreneur says, it's funny because when I first started thinking about it, I was like, well, what's your end goal? Money, freedom. Yeah.
Sure, absolutely.
But that's in the back of everyone's mind. Mm-hmm. But really, it is always seems to be like a means to an end for something that they're mm-hmm. truly passionate about. So really, what you're passionate about is becoming an inventor.
Mm-hmm.
So it is a means to an end.
Yeah, to play. The means to the end is to play.
Yeah.
You know, and inventing is play. It's just creative, you know. I mean, there's a zillion things I'd like to do, but it's all, you have to get money out of the way first. You know, like the guy said, I can't remember who it was, he says, money will never buy you happiness, but you'll probably never be happy without money. You know, and, you know, so you want to get that money thing out of the way.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, hey, going to the dentist costs money. You know, yeah. And if you don't have money to go to the dentist, let me tell you, a sore tooth is going to make you pretty unhappy.
That's very true.
So, you know, I think that's what that really means.
Okay, so I had something you said, maybe you want to ask you something else, but I'll continue with that. So where do you see yourself being at the end of this?
I don't know. You know, it's just a big ride. You just ride the ride, and it'll take you where it takes you. I have no idea. I mean, you know, I don't know if we're going to end up, you know.
Our head could collapse. There could be an earthquake.
Yeah, you know, anything could happen. You know, I guess the 2012, you know, the world could end or something stupid like that. But I don't believe in that at all. But no, I think a person could be surprised where they could end up. I mean, who knows? Maybe we'll build the biggest restaurant chain in history. I have no idea. You know, but we're going to find out. You know, you just have to kind of find out.
Okay, and then I'll just end it with you. Any final thoughts? Anything to write home?
I would just always to encourage people that that you'd be surprised what you can do if you put your mind to it. You should never put your dreams to the side. In other words, you should never say, well, I'm never going to be able to achieve that. Because you can if you really want to. If you really want to, you can pull it off, whatever it is you want to do. So I think a lot of people... They what do they call that? It's not mediocrity.
Settle.
Yeah, they settle.
Yeah.
And I just think that I think, you know, I have a lot of people that work for me, and they could grow. They could do what I do, but they have not made the commitment to pay the price, to put in the time, to pull it off. But they could do it if they wanted to. I mean, you could be the next leader of the free world if you wanted to be. The question is, do you really want to be?
Yeah.
You know, probably not. I don't desire to. You know, it's too much stress.
Well, he does play golf a lot, though.
Oh, you know, maybe. But I, you know, I could never be president of the country or something like that, because the fact of the matter is, no matter what you do, half the people hate you and half the people love you. And I would never want to be in that situation.
Okay.
Because that's, you know, it's not fun. So, there you go.
That's the end. I appreciate your time.
Not a problem.